This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Hey, welcome to Business Made Personal. Thank you so much for putting us in your ears today. We really appreciate it. I've got with me today Jenny Bax. Now, Jenny Bax is the National Development Manager for ANZFAR Australia and has spent over 20 years in senior management roles. A Master of Business Administration and holding a graduate diploma in insurance, Jenny has made her mark leading teams in business profitability through periods of significant change. She attributes some of her success to being able to analyse external market factors, understanding threats and opportunities, and has a proven ability to identify, strategise, and implement practices which achieve results. Thank you for joining us today, Jenny.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, Jenny, I'm interested in talking to you initially about prior to business life. You know, where did you grow up? What was your background like? What was that like early on in your life?
I grew up in Brisbane in the northern suburbs, in a suburb called West Chermside. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. We lived in a small old wooden house, I guess, for want of a better word. Mum and Dad constantly worked. I don't remember a time when neither of them were working, particularly Mum. So she was running the household and also pulling down one or two jobs. She was working during the day and sometimes doing care for elderly people at nighttime as well. So she was really busy. I'd say we were middle class family, but I don't know if we really had a lot of money when you think about it. I look back now, we got everything that we wanted and our parents never, you know, provided everything for us and gave us every opportunity to succeed. But I'm not sure we really had a lot of money. And I think they did it tough, but made sure that they showed me that if you work hard and you can really put in the effort, you can make something of your life and support your family moving forward.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Particularly your mother was working two jobs. Was that because that was her nature, or was it because she felt that the family needed to provide it for?
Interesting. I think it was probably a bit of both. She has a really good work ethic, similar to my dad, and I guess that's how we were brought up. But I think she always wanted to just do that little bit more. My sister was my national age champion for swimming. My brother was a really good sportsman, and I was pretty good at sport as well. So we were doing a lot of travelling, I guess, with our different sports. So they needed that extra money, I guess, to help us. To make sure that we had the right caps and uniforms and everything so that we looked the part when we were representing our teams, etc. So I guess it just became par for the course and it was what she did but she still managed to run a household as well. So she was pretty inspirational, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely. And, the fact that you guys all had some sort of sporting prowess, what was your specialty?
So I was a netballer, did a lot of netballing, but also I did a lot of singing back in the day. I was toured Australia and New Zealand. I did a duet on a record. I won every Stedford in Queensland, singing in Stedford. And I was also into musical comedy. So there was a lot of work, doing musicals and shows and also ballet, which obviously culminated in my musical comedy. So Mum was always putting together different costumes for me. She'd sit there and hand-stitch my tutus and everything like that. So I was netball, but there was also a lot of the arts involved as well from my perspective.
Wow, that's sensational. Did you carry that on in your later life?
I did, from a singing perspective. I did some theatre shows as I was older. I was heavily involved in weddings for a period of time, sometimes did two or three weddings on a weekend, but then it got to the stage I started doing funerals. I found that a little bit depressing, so I thought it was probably time to put the vocal cords away and give it a break.
Do you sing on the odd occasion today or not really?
Oh, yeah, you can't shut me up, really. I find it very thing. It's my stress relief, so you'll always see me in the car singing away to something. I love music, any sort of music. So there's always music on in the background somewhere for me.
That's fantastic. I want to move forward a little bit in your childhood. In year 10, you had a major significant event. Can you tell us what that was about?
Yeah, sure. So all I ever wanted to be when I was younger was a vet. From the age of about 5, I was vet. So everything I was doing from a scholastic perspective was heading in that direction. And when I was 15, I had a part-time job, as all 15-year-olds do. It was finishing about 6 o'clock and I had to head to a netball grading game after the part-time job. So my mum was at work to pick me up and I crossed the road to go into the car and a lady flew up the road in her vehicle, didn't see me. It was dusk. I didn't see her, and she ran over me. And I flew up the road, probably another house up the road, and landed headfirst into the gutter. So a fractured skull. I was in a coma for 8 days. And Mum had the dubious job of ringing my dad that night to say, get to the hospital. They don't think she's going to make it through the night. So my family had a bit of a vigil at the hospital for an 8-day period whilst I got through the coma and came out of that. And funnily enough, it was music that brought me out of the coma. The doctors asked Mum to bring music in so that they could play it beside my ear. And that was some of the stuff that helped to bring me out of the coma. But when I got out and I came home, I had an awful lot of issues with my fractured skull was quite serious. I had massive migraines. I had issues with my back and my legs, and we had a lot of recuperating that I needed to do. I lost probably about 12 months of my memory during that time, so pretty much the whole of year 10. And that sort of messed up my plans a little bit to be a vet. I needed to repeat year 10 if I wanted to continue on that path. But I was also pretty stubborn, and my brother would have been in the same class as me, my younger brother, and I didn't like that idea. So I decided to just stay at home and recuperate because I needed to, you know, get my head and everything back to normal. But I started getting a bit bored. I was lying on the lounge and Mum was fucking over me pretty bad. And I just looked in the paper one day and I saw a job for an insurance company, and it was for a 6-month contract converting paper records onto their computer. And I thought, oh, maybe I could do that. Surely 6 months I can hold down a job. So I applied for it. Funnily enough, I didn't know how to type because I wanted to be a vet and I never did typing class at school. But I applied for the job. The state manager put me on. I told him everything about my car accident, what had happened 6 months before, every pain, ache, you name it, I told him. I think he took pity on me, I think, and he gave me a job. And I guess the rest is history. The first 2 years, I think, were probably more memorable for the amount of time I had off work whilst I was trying to manage migraines particularly, because they were debilitating. I'd be in bed for 4 to 5 days when they hit. But Union Insurance gave me an opportunity. They stuck with me, and the 6-month contract became permanent after 2 years, and the rest is history.
You take me back to that time. So you're in year 10. How old were you then?
15.
Yeah, you said that previously. My apologies. So a 15-year-old who is basically not expected to live, you come out of it. Did you, apart from the migraines, did you suffer and the memory loss, did you suffer anything else? You know, was there any other lingering aspects that you had to deal with at that time?
Yes, there was. So my netball career was kiboshed as a result of that, because I had a lot of issues with my knees. They thought at one point I had a tumour in my right knee, but that turned out to be something else. So that was fine. But I've had a lot of knee issues. So netball was finished, and I still have to this day back and neck issues, and I'm always at a physio or a chiropractor or having a massage, particularly, and doing gym to keep everything strong. But you know, to me, it's a small price to pay. I'd rather be, you know, relatively healthy and doing a physio appointment rather than what the option could have been all those years ago.
Absolutely, and those sorts of things have a marked impact on people in terms of what they do with their future. Some people lie on the bed and do nothing. Other people decide to get up and make stuff happen. You're obviously in the latter camp. Was that a conscious decision that you made?
Yes, it was. I was bored out of my brain. I'm not someone to sit around. And whilst I know my parents were doing things for the right reasons, or what they thought were the right reasons, to really, you know, make sure that I was fit and healthy, and they were really worried about, obviously, the head knock and the memory loss, I wanted my life to get back to normal. I was a teenager. I wanted to have fun and I wanted to enjoy life. You know, I hadn't even finished year 10, so I didn't even have a junior certificate based on my results. It was based on the school average in the end, because I couldn't sit the last lot of exams. But I just wanted to be that person this can't be my life forever. I've got to move on and make something of it.
Yeah. So speaking of moving on, let's move on to 2022. You rejoined ANZVAR from Allianz, where you were the general manager for underwriting agencies. You have also held a number of senior national and international positions at QBE and worked at CGU Insurance. I wanted to ask you a question around the role of women in insurance. You know, I know that there's 40% of females in the insurance industry. I guess the question that I have for you is, of that 40%, do you believe that women are afforded the opportunities to advance in insurance, or do you still think that there's a glass ceiling sitting there?
It's a really good question. When I look back on my career, I would say, you know, 20, 30 years ago, definitely there was a glass ceiling. And there may be one now, but it's not as obvious, I guess. I do see women advancing easier, quicker. There's more opportunities for them. I guess some of that comes down to the quotas that we have from, you know, board level down. I'm not a big, whilst I think quotas are good to have as a guide, I think, you know, it obviously should be based on best person for the role, irrespective of sex. But I think we're getting smarter in the way that we look across the board and look to see what we need to drive a business forward, whether it be gender, ethnicity, thought leadership, et cetera. I think that makes a lot of difference. And we're a lot smarter in how we present the people that we want to portray our business moving forward. I guess the other thing that's probably made it easier too, in a way, is probably COVID, to be fair. Work-life balance now is the norm for everyone. It's expected that, you know, we all smarter with the way we balance our work life, and it's more equitable for everybody. So I think that probably is a bit of a step up for females as well.
So that's an interesting point, the whole COVID thing, right? Because now we've got the great resignation. People have reevaluated their lives and they're saying, you know what, thanks for the memories. I'm going to pack my bongos and I'm going to go and do something else, or I'm going to spend more time at home with my family. Do you think there's an opportunity now, and you know, resourcing for insurance companies, for intermediaries, for everybody is a real bugbear. You know, finding people and attracting them and retaining them is a challenge. Do you think that there is an opportunity now for people who may have been out of the workplace to re-enter the insurance market, given the fact that, you know, we're looking for people?
There's definitely a shortage of skills. There's a shortage of knowledge. I think there's so many people that have left the industry that have untapped knowledge that we haven't been able to grab before they left and, you know, cultivate for other people. If we could find a way to garner that energy, garner those people, bring them back into the business on their terms, whether that be 1, 2, 3 days a week, however that works for them, that can only be better for everyone. We've got a group of young people that are screaming out for all this additional knowledge and education, and we just don't have the resources to give it to them. So the people that have left the business, a lot of the people there have lots of skill sets that we really should be trying to grab onto and to harness as much as we can so that we can build a resilient business for the future.
And, you know, you mentioned young people there. Do you see, you and I have been around a little while, when I got into a job, and I don't know what it was like for you, but it was expected that you would be there, well, basically forever. With the younger people coming through now, do you see that that's still the case, or do they have a different view on their work careers?
No, the millennials are totally different to how we were brought up. I guess in this day and age, I think some of the figures that I've seen over the years is, you know, in the first 10 years, a millennial will have, you know, 3 to 5 roles and jump as quickly as they can. And I know, and I understand that they want to move forward as quickly as they can and step up that ladder. I totally understand that. But, you know, it needs to be done at a pace that is comparable to their ability and comparable to the speed of the business, I guess. So it makes it hard. It's expensive. It's horribly expensive when we're constantly retraining and recruiting for roles because we've got that gap of people moving forward. We really need to find a structure in our businesses where the employees are really comfortable and understand what their development plans are going to be. We don't expect them to stay forever, but if you could get that chunk of 5 to 10 years, you can really build some strong skill sets for them and also some really good outputs for your business as well.
And I think, you know, it's fair to say that insurance isn't the sexy career that, you know, some other professions may be. And I guess the question is, how do we continue to attract those younger people and not just fall into it like I did and possibly you?
Better at it again as an industry with the careers in insurance, and a lot of the insurance companies are going and spending time at some of those schools and the universities to spruik their wares, for want of a better word. These days, you could have a marketing degree, HR, legal, you know, finance, commerce, you name it, and you can pretty much land on your feet in the business. And I think the other beauty is probably 20 years ago, if you moved into the role of an underwriter, you pretty much stayed as an underwriter. This day and age, the world's your oyster. You really have the opportunity to jump and to really identify where is my passion, where's my happy place, and where do I really want to put my roots in and build a career from here. So I think there's just a lot more opportunity these days, but it's selling that story to the people because, like, you're right, it's not a sexy industry. We're not seen as one of those go-to places. We're probably a lot further down the food chain than you'd like to think where we should be. It's a lot of work, and I guess it's up to us. We all need to sell that story of the journey that we've been on, the opportunities we've had, but also the fun that we've had along the way.
Yeah. And it's not just an Australian story. I mean, it's a global story. You know, one of the great things about being in our industry in Australia that we're very well recognised throughout the world for our talent and for our ability. So, you know, you're not just confined to Australia. Hey, I wanted to speak to you, Jenny, about some time between 2021 and 2022 where you took a career break for a short period. What prompted that?
Okay, so everyone has a bit of a hard luck story, I guess. And that period between 2021 and 2022 was probably my annus horribilis year. We actually had three traumatic family issues that happened during that time. My partner's son and daughter-in-law, they had a stillborn baby at 40 weeks, and that was obviously horrendously traumatic for the whole family. Whitaker would have been the first granddaughter in the family, and she was, you know, 40 weeks and 2 days to be precise, and it was just one freak accidents that happened, and that takes a lot out of a family, and it puts a lot of stress and pain into a family, I guess. The other episode was there was a cancer diagnosis within my family as well, someone very close to me, and we were dealing with that a couple of months after the loss of Whitaker. And then the third, the trifecta would have been my sister had two heart attacks within the space of 2 weeks. And that again was November 2021. So all this happened probably in the space of about 2.5 months. It really just got to the point. It was like, I do a lot of work for my sister and her kids. I support them and help them out as much as I can. And watching all that Jackie was going through with her young family and then family issues that we had, particularly with the loss of Whitaker, I just needed to bring everyone together and felt like I needed to regroup. So maybe it was a mother hen coming out of me, I don't know, but I needed to make sure that I could help everybody, be there for everybody, because I normally work, you know, long hours, which is fine, and I put my head down and get stuck into that, but I needed to change my focus and spend time with family to help them to recover and do what they needed to do to come out of it as best as we could.
Yeah, understood. And that would have been, you know, trying to deal with that and work at the same time. You know, just dealing with one of those things would be difficult, but dealing with three would have been just insurmountable. Just taking you over the 20-year journey that, or 30-year journey that you've had in insurance, what do you think the industry has given you personally that you never expected to get out of it, Jenny?
I guess the industry has given me the opportunity to understand myself, understand what I enjoy and where I want to go. I started my career as an underwriter, converting records, as I said, onto a computer system. I then moved into domestic insurance, and I had a passion. I was inquisitive about, you know, the proposal forms and asking questions. What does this mean? What happens if they enter it this way? And I started wanting to lure insurance, and had a bit of a passion for it. And that's when I decided I needed to do a bit of study as well to support me. But once I moved, and I was always going to be an underwriter. That's all I thought I'd ever be. So it's not all I'd ever be. I thought I was going to be a senior underwriter. I was going to be a national underwriting manager. You know, I had a plan in place, chief underwriting officer. That was my plan. But then I had the opportunity to move into distribution and realised relatively soon that that was probably my happy place, being able to deal with brokers, be in the market, have some of those tough conversations, really try and build relationships and create opportunities for the broker and the end client. And then, you know, even post that, I've also had opportunities in operations and compliance, and both of those have helped me to really round out my skill set. I guess what it's afforded me is the opportunity to spread my wings, be able to dive into different things, build my toolkit along the way, understand where my passion is, but also have continued to learn, because from my perspective, the key to success for me is education, continuing to learn, finding new ways to develop yourself. That's what's going to move me forward.
And I don't think you ever stop learning in our space, do you really?
No, not at all. And that's the beauty. Again, if you've got an inquisitive mind, this is where you want to be.
I want to talk a little bit about people that you've come across. And let's not start with the business side of things. Let's start with your life. You've mentioned your parents at the start of this podcast, but I'm wondering if there's been another influential person in your life, and how did they impact you?
So influential. So obviously, probably one of the most influential people for me probably would have been Donna Walker, absolute legend in the insurance industry. And she was someone that I had admired for a long time at CGU. I knew Donna at CGU, but never had the opportunity to work for her. she was actually the reason that I left ANZAR after 12 months and moved to Allianz, because I did get the opportunity to work alongside Donna. I knew she had so much to give the industry. She was so passionate about females. She was passionate about the younger insurance generation, bringing them forward and giving them opportunities to develop. And I knew she would be able to help me finesse some of my leadership skills, because I'd seen her in action so many times and a joy to watch. She was passionate about what she did, but she was so serene and sedate in the way she delivered her messages, but on point in every instance. So Donna was probably the standout from my perspective, and probably one other. I had a male years ago at Union and CEGU who also gave me opportunities to spread my wings, for want of a better word, and really jump in and have a go where I wasn't comfortable. He actually liked letting me jump, and then he had a rope if I needed it, obviously, but was more than happy to work with me so that I could continue to build my skills and explore the unknown and the scary parts of insurance, I guess.
And there's a lot to be said for allowing people to fail and being there to support them if they do. I wanted to ask you, in terms of yourself, there's a saying that I use in a lot of the podcasts, which is that successful people, not just a result of the mistakes they make, but more importantly, what they learn from those mistakes. What do you think you've learned from some of the mistakes you've made?
Yes, it's a really good question, and there's a lot of mistakes I've made along the way. But I guess the big thing for me would be not to assume that I know all the answers. You know, I don't know all the answers to everything. I've really learned now, don't be afraid to ask questions. And don't be embedded to your own biases too much. So I'm really conscious of that when I'm trying to make decisions. And I think the big thing is, you know, we all make mistakes at any time. So we need to make sure that own up to them quickly so that you can learn from them and move on. What I do, a lot of what I've learned also now, is planning and prioritizing. I think it's really important. If you do it properly, it reduces those surprise factors. You know, we've all had surprise factors. And that can lead ones that we don't expect to have, and they lead to the outcomes that we really didn't want. So I'm much better at planning and prioritizing. And there is one area that is definitely a work in progress from my perspective. One of my old bosses at QBE gave me a book. I think it was Richard Carlson, and the book's called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. And it's a really good book, and it gives you tips to stop you know, the annoying things. You know, when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you've got this silly little thought going through your head, but you cannot shut it down, and you don't sleep for 2 hours. We all do it. This book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, helps you to stop those things taking over your life. Now, I do have to say, as I said, it is a work in progress. I'm not brilliant at it, but it's something that I'm more conscious of. I try not to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and worry about the stuff that I can't fix at this point in time. It focuses on the things that are in your control, and I guess that's the bit that I'm working on.
I might have to get a copy of the book myself. Jenny, I wanted to ask you, if you were able to go back and have a chat with that young 15-year-old who's just come out of hospital and recuperating at home, what advice would you give that young lady?
So the advice I'd probably give myself would be, you've earned a seat at the table, use your voice. I think in the early days, I sat back and I listened, and I had that voice in my head that said, don't say anything, it's going to sound stupid, don't open your mouth, it's going to be stupid. And that's not right. You know, if you learn over time that you should be asking questions, you should be voicing your opinion. And someone actually said to me, you earned a seat at the table, so make sure you use it. So that, I would have done that a lot earlier. I think instead of sitting back and listening, and I do reflect and I do listen to people, and I think that is a good quality to have. But I also think can be at the detriment if you don't speak up. You may not be seen as influential as you could be. You often have some really good opinions that you should be providing, but it's that voice in the back of your head that can stop you. So if you can shut the voice down, you're going to get a long way.
So that's really interesting, because a lot of people have that problem, right? Because they don't want to sound stupid when they open their mouth. They don't want people to think less of them because they've opened their mouth. They don't want to take up time and space. I'm just wondering if that's a learning due to experience as opposed to a natural instinct.
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I think there is an experience thing. So I think from my perspective, experience has taught me to do that. I think I'm actually rather introverted, probably not my natural disposition. I am, as I said, more of a reflector. I'll listen to what people say, put it through my mind, and then a judgment. But sometimes I think you need to be, these days, I realise you need to be a lot quicker with your decisions, You need to voice an opinion. I'm also think it's important that it doesn't matter if it's the wrong thing. The fast fail is very good. If you want to say something, you want to do something, have a fast, do it. If it's a fast fail, move on and try something else. But it's definitely, I think, learned from my perspective more so than the natural go-to. And I think it's a confidence thing. And I guess it's people also supporting you and knowing you're in that safe environment where you can, if you're in a safe environment, you don't mind opening your mouth and voicing something that may be a bit different or a bit controversial to what everyone else is thinking.
Yeah, so that's a critical factor, isn't it? Having that safe environment to be able to voice it and know that people aren't going to think any less of you. How do you create that? Because a lot of businesses don't have it.
It's really understanding your peers, your leaders, developing those really strong relationships with that core group of people that you'll be working with on a regular basis, and identifying where your similarities are and where your differences are. I don't think it's something that happens overnight and you're never going to get it 100% correct. But if you can identify a couple of people in particular that you really feel safe and valued with, I think that goes a long way to driving better outcomes, wider thought processes, more inclusivity and, you know, the opportunity to succeed, which is both from a personal perspective and from a business perspective.
We're speaking with Jenny Bax, who's the National Development Manager for ANZVAR Australia. Jenny, Alex Conlon, Director of AMC Insurance, said of you, and I quote, "Jenny has the highest level of commitment to guide and encourage not only myself, but many other colleagues across the insurance sector." Full stop. "I look forward to working with Jenny into the future and can only hope that over my career, I am able to lead others by the same examples she has." End of quote. The question I have for you, what is it that you do differently?
I'm not sure I do anything differently at all. I'm really passionate. Alex was one of my mentees when I was in South Australia, and I'm really passionate about them succeeding. Every person that succeeds in our business helps to obviously build the reputation of our business. From my perspective, when you go through a NIBA mentoring program, they normally last for 12 weeks or something like that. None of the mentoring programs that I've done with my mentees last that long. They always go on indefinitely, as long as the mentee wants to continue that sort of process. There's nothing better from my perspective in watching someone grow and develop. When that light bulb comes on, the smile on their face, when they realise that jackpot, they've hit gold and they've really understood something they've been struggling with, that's what my day. I really don't think I do anything different. It's just the opportunity to, I give them the opportunity to continue the program as long as they want to. The regularity is up to them. Formal, informal, it doesn't worry me. It's just, as long as I can help them continue to grow and flourish, then we're going to both be successful out of it.
And I just want to also talk about education, because you mentioned that previously and I wanted to come back to it. You completed your MBA in 2010, if I'm correct. Yeah. What value has that been to you in advancing your career, do you think?
I guess from my perspective, I was looking for a differentiator at that point in time with work. I wanted something for me to stand out. We were going through a lot of restructures, as all insurance companies do. And I wanted to have that piece that was a bit different, that showed Jenny Bax was a bit different to everyone else in at her level within the company. I'd already completed my fellowship and my grad dip through ANZIF, and I knew there was still a piece of the puzzle that wasn't quite right. So my learning journey wasn't over, and I needed to do more to invest in my future, I guess. From my perspective, the MBA was the logical step. What it did for me, big time from my perspective, is it's given me obviously a more strategic mindset. But where I was struggling previously was I was probably spending too much time on the dance floor and I wasn't sitting up in the balcony observing what was going on. Once I'd done my MBA, I saw things in a different light and realised the perspective that you get when you can see the full picture when you move yourself away from the business. So having the ability to do that and understanding what that does for me moving forward has been probably the biggest highlight of completing the MBA.
Moving off that and moving on to something a little bit different, talking about the industry, one of your stated aims has been restoring public confidence in the aftermath of Financial Services Royal Commission. How well do you think we're doing that as a profession?
I think when you look back over the last 3 years, the industry's come an awful long way. And I think as a collective, we're much more conscious of public opinion. And I guess the importance of changing the rhetoric and actually doing what we say we're going to do. I guess it's a case of putting your money where your mouth is. There's been an awful lot of money spent by insurance companies, whether it be people, you know, for people, governance, reporting. There's been a huge impost on the businesses moving. But when you think about it, the regulatory reforms that have come into play in the last 18 months, whilst they've been onerous on the insurance companies in putting their plans and processes in place to deliver them within the time frame, they've obviously gone a long way to supporting fairer outcomes to the customers, which is what the whole aim of all the regulatory change has been. So I don't think we're paying lip service. I think it's really important. I think the insurance industry has come an awful long way. We've probably got further to do. But at this point in time, when you think about, you know, product design and distribution, target market determination, even complaints handling, unfair contract terms, and, you know, the changes to the code of practice, et cetera, that's a lot of stuff in an 18-month period, and we've come out of it. We're doing well, and if it's taken that to change the mindset of the public, then that's what we needed to do.
I just wonder if that's such a big project, you know, changing the mindset of the general public in the current climate, where if you look at how most insurance companies advertise, it's we can save you money, as opposed to we'll give you a better cover, or let's talk about, you know, when your claims are going to get paid. I just wonder if, in some respects, we are our own worst enemy.
I think we are. You know, claims is obviously with the rubber where the rubber hits the road, and that's where we want to make sure that we're shining and we are, you know, ticking all the boxes for the end customer. We needed to do something. We had to improve what we were doing. The Royal Commission really, you know, told just how bad it was in some areas. And if that was the case, you know, the public obviously had a perception, and it was proven, and that's not a good thing. I guess what we need to do now in the aftermath is work on how do we improve the industry reputation. We do some really good stuff. You know, when we pay claims, we help people, you know, put them back in the position they were immediately prior to losses. But we're hopeless at selling a story. You know, we can't sell the good things of the industry at all. And I really don't understand why. We don't beat our chests enough to say, this is what we've done. We only hear the stuff that we see on the current affair where the one claim that went wrong. And unfortunately, that, you know, that gets all the news rather than all those claims that we've paid out, all that work we've done supporting vulnerable customers, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know the answer to that, but I think as a group, we need to continue to work on delivering a more positive message on obviously the benefits of insurance. I guess if we're driving insurance as a real business and a real career future, obviously if we get the right people into the business, they'll be able to sell the story as well. But it's going to be a long road before we get to that point where we are, you know, where we are a business that you want to support and to see as a real future.
And you make a great point. You know, I recently emceed the Mansfield Awards in Sydney. And they had a new award this year, which was the Purple Award, for someone who had gone out of their way and done something spectacular for their clients. And the young lady that won it, her house was flooded during the recent floods. She left her home, drove for 4 hours to help out one of her clients. You just don't hear that stuff, right? And that's not an isolated incident. I know of many, many cases from businesses I've worked in where people have gone above and beyond the call of duty. But as you correctly say, that doesn't make a current affair.
No, unfortunately it doesn't. And I can even tell you a story similar. When I was at QBE, we had a client who came to us about 8 weeks after Innes Vale was absolutely wiped out. She came in to put a claim in, and it turned out her house had been absolutely decimated, and she was living in a shed, which was a bare shed. And we asked what had happened, why she didn't come in earlier to put a claim in, and she said there were people who had worse issues than her. She was okay. She had a roof over her head. And she was an elderly lady, but, you know, her attitude was, no, there's people that are worse off than me. I'm okay. I can wait.
In fact, I think we did that job when I was at Steamatic, if I recall correctly, because I remember that story really clearly. So I can certainly back that one up. Jenny, I just wanted to ask you about your role. What do you think is the most difficult part of being in your position?
Interesting question. So from my perspective, I would say the most difficult, but also probably the most rewarding, is leading people, obviously. You know, you don't get a handbook how to lead successfully. And I've found I've had to change my style over the years to suit the individual, but also the situation. And definitely learn it's not a one-size-fits-all, that's for sure. You know, leadership has and will always continue to evolve. So for me, the hardest part has obviously been the leading, but it's rewarding because I continually want to listen to podcasts. You know, I want to develop my style. I want to make sure that it continues to flow naturally so that it continues to become a genuine extension of who I am. So whilst, you know, I love leading people. So whilst it's challenging, it's never easy. It's also probably one of the most rewarding parts of my job.
And speaking about challenges, what's been the most challenging time in your career?
So interesting. I would say probably the most challenging time would have been when I was in Manila with QBE Insurance. From a work perspective, in the first six months that I was there, we had a flood, a typhoon, and also an earthquake. So, you know, three natural disasters that hit in the first 3 months. I had to ensure that I had a workforce that could support the onshore business during all of these events. So that was extremely challenging because all of the staff lived 2 to 3 hours away from the office in Fort Bonifacio. So there was the tyranny of distance for them from the start. And then when they had these sort of issues on top of that, it just caused ongoing roll-on effects. So that was probably the most challenging, managing through those successfully. But then obviously from a personal perspective, it would have been the family events that happened in 2021.
Managing all of those catastrophes at the one time and the people issues associated with them, what did you have to change in terms of how you approached it?
The hardest thing to change was really making sure that we understood what was happening with everybody and their families. You know, obviously safety was paramount for everybody, so we needed to make sure the staff were safe and their families were safe, but I also needed to make sure that I could quickly advise Australia if there was issues from a resourcing perspective, because we still had a business to run onshore and we needed to make sure that we could pivot really quickly if needed to bring, you know, resources back where they needed to be to keep the business going. It taught me that a lot of the staff had amazing resilience. They just never stopped. They did whatever they could to get to QBE. They absolutely bled blue. They were so passionate about the business. I'll just give you an example of a story that I had during that time when we had the floods, which was the first issue. One of my managers rang me probably an hour after he's normally at work to say that he was running late, that, you know, obviously the floods had slowed him down, but he'd be at work as soon as he could. So I said, okay, be careful. You know, if you can't make it, don't worry, turn around, just give me a call. He said, no, all good, I'll be there. So I was running between floors doing the workforce planning. And probably an hour later, I got another phone call from him saying, I'm sorry, Jenny, I'm still getting there, just taking me a bit longer. And I said, is everything safe? Are you okay, John? He said, yep, it's all good. And I said, okay, I'll see you when you get here. Fast forward about 2 hours later, I realised he hadn't arrived and I didn't get a phone call from him. And he said, I'm so sorry, I've had to turn around. I couldn't make it into work. And I said, that's okay. Is everyone all right? Are you safe? And he said, yeah, it's fine. But he said, what happened was I drove my car until the water flapped on the tyres, so I parked my car. I then hitchhiked on the back of a truck until the truck couldn't go any further. And then I decided to walk. And he said, when the water was up to my shoulders, I realised it probably wasn't safe and I needed to turn around and go back. All he wanted to do was get to work because he had a job to do and he was passionate about QBE.
You talk about work ethic, there's proof right there, right?
It is. When I went back home to Australia, was if we could bottle up that resilience and that passion and you could bring it all over back home in Australia, you'd have the best insurance company in the world because the passion they have, the success is just, it's unbelievable.
I want to ask you a couple more questions before we let you off the hook, Jenny Bax. The first one is, if you could change one thing about our industry, what would you change?
If I could change one thing about our industry, it would be probably our reputation. I would do anything. I'd love to be on a mission to be part of that group, and I guess I am part of that group, in changing our reputation. Baby steps, making it the industry become something that everyone should be proud of, making the industry something that is an industry of choice, is, you know, a recruiter of choice, a business for a career, a long career. That would be my aim, and I'm not sure how long it's going to take to get there, but I'm definitely going to continue doing what I can do to help support it.
Well, the good news is that a number of people that have been on this podcast have got the same view. So I think if we got together collectively, we could probably make a bit of a difference. I'm just trying to work out how we can drive that bus. You know, how do we get those people together and actually put in place a strategy that assists that aim?
Yeah, it would be amazing because there's so many people with the same passion and we've had so much fun. We've worked hard. We've learned so much. We've gained so many friends, so much knowledge, so many skills. It's really worth getting together and trying to find a way to make it happen.
Hey, if you knew one thing back then that you know now, is there anything you'd devote more time to?
Probably, as I said before, voicing my opinion sooner, not sitting back and listening as much, probably being more vocal at the table. As I said, someone said to me, you earned your seat at the table, make sure that you use it. So that to me would be the most important thing in if I was looking back on myself and what I would do differently.
And final question for you, what's next for Jenny Bax?
In the next 12 months, I guess, I've got a few things on up my sleeve because I am one of those people that can't sit still, to be honest. When I was on my sabbatical, I was thinking about crisis care counselling at Lifeline, particularly when I saw the pain that our kids went through with the passing of Whittaker. I want to find a way to help people because I can understand how, you know, people get to some really dark places when you have those sort of events happen. So I did do some investigation on what I needed to do to become a counsellor, and I will, early next year, I'll start to work on the course to get there. It takes about 170 hours of work, but that's fine because I also have a bit of a urge at the moment to do some study. So I can kill two birds with one stone and then be able to volunteer a few hours a week with Lifeline. So that's something I'm really passionate about doing early next year. And the other thing is, from a work perspective particularly, you know, I've only been at ANZFI now for 6 months, but I really want to continue. I want to drive positive outcomes for ANZFI to work with them. Like, we're a really niche insurer, and I reckon we're a bit of a sleeping giant in our segment. So I want to be out there talking to the brokers. You know, we're not QBE, Allianz, or CGU. I want to put us at the top of the list when they've got the specific risks that, you know, suit our sector sort of thing. And I want us to be the insurer of choice moving forward for those ones. And I guess, lastly, probably any opportunity I get, I'll grab it, I'll run with it, see what I can make of it, and make sure, as much as I can, make sure that I have fun along the way.
Hey, Jenny Bax, it's been an absolute delight having you on Business Made Personal. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Mark. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.